Elon Musk did not start at Tesla. Thomas Edison did not start with GE. Hewlett-Packard started in a garage. Facebook started in a dorm room. All of these companies started small. And that's where the innovation comes from. That's where the S-curve comes in investment and returns on investment. And then they're able to hire people, which adds to our economy. But if you kill small business, you kill innovation in America.
Elected by his peers to be their Senate Minority Leader and respected for his ability to reach across the political aisle to get things done for Californians. Today's guest is State Senator Brian Jones, who will discuss what needs to be done to fix California and what can really be achieved in this polarized political age. I'm Tony Melandra, NFIB California's Senior Media Manager. We're proud to have this podcast supported in part by Five Star Bank, serving customers through specialized banking solutions for entrepreneurs, business owners, and community leaders in Northern California. From his successes in bringing transparency to the state's licensing process, to supporting the growing craft beverage industry, to equally important accomplishments on social issues, such as uplifting homeless students and protecting foster children from child labor trafficking, Senator Jones knows what it takes to bring elected officials together for a common cause, a skill he honed as a city councilman, assembly member, and now a state senator. Having owned a small business and knowing firsthand all the sweat and toil that goes into providing employees with livelihoods makes him a valued ally of Main Street enterprises. Senator Jones and his family make their home in Santee in San Diego County. In 2022, he was elected to represent California's 40th Senate District, which includes the cities of Escondido, Poway, San Marcos, Santee, and 13 smaller communities and 14 unincorporated locales in the San Diego area. Here to lead the discussion with Senator Jones is NFIB California's Chief Legislative Advocate, Tim Taylor, who, in addition to representing clients in his own firm since 2009, brings longtime state government and state legislative experience to the job. Take it away, Tim.
Tony, thank you for that introduction. We're really pleased to have Senator Jones with us today. Let's just jump right in. As a former small business owner yourself, and your wife is a current small business owner, tell us what you think some of the challenges are in California for small businesses generally.
Well, in the state of California, you know, right now, the state and local municipalities are just really making it difficult to start a business here. And if you've already started and been operating for a period of time, it's just becoming more and more difficult to stay opened. And I think, you know, I get asked this question quite a bit, and people ask, why doesn't the legislature understand this, that the business community is really struggling here in California, and of all sizes, right? From my wife works from home, but she's all over Southern California. So she's driving all the time. She's in and out of stores. She is a health food broker, and then she also has a interior decorating business. So she's dealing with, not only is she a small business owner, but everybody she deals with is a small business owner, you know, paint supplies, interior decorating supplies, or if she's dealing with her grocery business, she's in the grocery stores. And she's actually very good eyes and ears for me because everybody she deals with knows that I'm a legislator. And so they're always giving her feedback. And, you know, for example, during the pandemic, one of the grocery stores that she works with was very concerned about a lot of the things that the state was doing to require them to be able to stay open. And some of them just weren't doable. And so where does that come from, you know, in the state of California? Well, ultimately, it comes from having a full-time legislature, because what we have now are professional legislators that on the Republican side, especially in the Senate, most Republicans have owned a business or currently own a business. As a matter of fact, I can't think of an exception to that. I mean, even one of our Republicans is a retired firefighter, but his wife owns a tax accounting business. So he's involved in that. So he understands it. On the Democrat side of the legislature, you know, very few of them have owned a business. Some of them have and have built and ran and sold very successful businesses. And I think you can kind of point to them as the leading centrists, or what the common phrase in Sacramento right now is the Mod Dems. That group is led by Democrats that have owned a business. But even more disappointing than that is the number of Democrats that have not owned a business. Many of them have never worked what I call a real job, meaning a job in the economy that's not supported by some kind of government tax deal. So even to the point of many of them haven't even waited tables while they were in college. And if you think about it, you know, somebody waiting tables at a restaurant, that's actually a micro small business. When you have to wait a table and serve your customers, make sure that they're getting what they ordered, make sure that they're happy so you can get a tip. That's about as small business and free enterprise as you can get. They don't even have that experience.
And I have noticed, too, that with so many new members, 30-plus new members, that's a giant percentage as well.
Right.
And immediately they kind of want to show their bona fides.
Right.
And they want to come out of the gate swinging, and they really have in a lot of instances.
Right.
And they've done a lot of damage, or at least they're proposing to do a lot of damage, more damage to small business interests.
So there's a couple of things there. And going back to so what kind of jobs have these people had, you know, before they got to the legislature? Well, a lot of them, you know, went to a public university on some kind of public scholarship. They graduated from university with a liberal arts degree in political science, which there's very little science in politics, by the way. It's mostly art, as you know. And then they get a job either working in the legislature, working in education, working for a government labor union, or working for a think tank or an association. And look, I'm not saying they don't work hard, and I'm not saying they don't earn the money that they're making in those jobs, but what I'm saying is those are not economy jobs. Those are theoretical jobs.
Yeah, those are not jobs where you're trying to make payroll and you're signing the front of a check.
Okay, so that's a good point that you're making. So even in the case of a CEO of one of these organizations, still is not the same as a CEO running a business. If you're the CEO of an organization that is supported by government funding, or even to some case nonprofits, you're not the one having to be creative every day on figuring out on Monday morning, okay, I got to do such and I got to do A, B, C, D, E, F to be able to make payroll on Friday, as opposed to a CEO of a company that every day has to wake up and, or even a small business owner, a plumbing shop, a plumber that has 6 or 7 plumbers working for him. That guy wakes up on Monday morning. He actually probably didn't sleep Sunday night. He gets up Monday morning and knows by Friday he's got to make $25, $50, $100,000 worth of payroll and then pay the taxes and all that too. Many of my colleagues and the people that work for them, that doesn't make any sense to them. They have no concept of that.
Yeah. I was actually talking, I don't know if she's a constituent or not, but I know she's a friend of yours, Ann Kinner. I was chatting with her, and we were talking about the new minimum wage increase, and she said, yes, that's hurtful, but she said, Tim, it doesn't just stop with the minimum wage increase.
Right.
That's bad enough. And by the way, her core business is she has something called Seabreeze Books and Charts, which sounds like a really interesting business selling charts.
She's got a great shop. I've been there.
To sailors in that industry. It's really fascinating. Anyway, she was saying it's everything else. So, you know, when electric bills go up, that hurts her.
Right.
When gasoline prices go up, that hurts her. Supply chain issues, kind of on and on and on. And for her, interestingly, in her niche that she lives in, the retail price of books are set, right?
Right.
You can't do it yourself. They're set, imprinted on the book. She says, I have to be very careful because the cost of books and paper are going up so high that when I get new books in, I need to make sure they have the same retail price as the ones already on the shelf.
Right.
That is changing so quickly.
Right.
So there are a lot of challenges for a small business owner, even beyond the onerous minimum wage increase to $15.50 this year.
What my colleagues don't understand, or maybe they do, and it is on purpose, every time they raise a tax, put a regulation, increase the cost of doing business, they're squeezing the little people out, the little and mid-sized businesses as well. You know, so you look at Ann's business. When she retires, okay, is there any value left in that business because the state has absorbed, you know, any margin that she's had in that? And so what happens? You know, I'm using Ann because you used Ann, but let's make it more generic than that. A business that they get to the end and they want to retire, and they're at a point where the government has squeezed every margin out of every aspect of their business to where they don't have anything that they can sell. And so now that business, rather than selling and continuing on with a new proprietor, goes out of business. And we're seeing this all over the state, you know, by the way. You know, people that built this state, people that started their businesses in the 70s and the 80s that are now, you know, getting to the point where they've hung on probably 10 years longer than they already meant to, just trying to get out of it. They can't get out of it. They goes out of business. And now what happens? That business is now replaced by a bigger corporation. Whatever services or products that they're offering now only is going to be available by the large corporations that can afford to do business here in California and comply with all these ridiculous, minuscule regulations that we're getting. And we're moving closer and closer to a command and control economy in California. I mean, California is perfecting a socialist economy.
Right.
We're moving that direction. Senator Dalley mentioned it today regarding the governor's extreme profits gas tax bill that we're doing.
Certainly feels much more like a controlled economy than a free economy.
Correct.
And I think what really exacerbated that, which may have been, you know, something that excited the left, was the pandemic.
Right.
You know, in March of 2020, we wanted to slow the spread. We thought maybe it was going to be a couple of weeks. The government actively shut down small businesses. They didn't shut down big businesses.
Right. Right.
They were told that, you know, small businesses, many of them were non-essential. And so recovering from that has been incredibly difficult. You really want to reignite an economic engine. You don't do it by more regulation, more taxation. You do the exact opposite of
right.
that. You're going to set them free.
Right.
And they cannot bring themselves to do that in the state. And we are suffering. We're, small businesses are going out of business, or they're leaving the state, as we well know, as well.
So just think about what you just said there. And it was said in the essential, non-essential.
Right.
Right. Where did that even come from? Like, they came up with that in a matter of days that— And it came all the way down from the federal government, right? Like, my son's an engineer for a defense contractor. Well, that was essential for some reason. My other son worked at a large retailer. So that, for some reason, was essential. But the small businesses, like you're saying, weren't essential. Well, who says where in America that the government has the authority to say who's essential and who's not essential? That's completely anathema to the foundation of our country and our economic concepts here in America. And so I remember the second week of the shutdowns, driving down the street in San Diego and being the car on the road and looking around at all the strip malls, no cars in the parking lot, some of the restaurants trying to stay open. So every day I would go to a restaurant and post on my social media, hey, this guy's open, this restaurant's open, this restaurant's open, come order. So I immediately became very concerned about that because I don't believe that the government has the right to do what they did. And I wrote an article on protecting our liberties and where our liberties going to go under this regime. I can't soften that term. It was a regime at the time and still. And the Union Tribune actually ran it. And I outlined in April of 2020 to San Diegans and everybody that picked up that op-ed, this is the time that we need to be vigilant and pay attention to what our government's doing, because somehow they think they have this authority. I don't think they do. And what we've seen borne out over in the courts, but it took way too long, right? I mean, churches sued the state, businesses sued the state, or associations sued the state. You can't shut us down. You can't shut us down. And the state lost most of those lawsuits.
But at that point, the damage is already done.
The damage is already done, and people have already gotten used to it and given up their freedom. Right. It's unbelievable to me.
And I think that the government enjoys that dynamic, sadly. I mean, there's 30 million small businesses in the United States. 30 million
right.
small businesses. They're responsible for 50% of the GDP. It's huge. It's
right.
massive. It's
right.
what made America the most prosperous
right.
country
right.
on the planet.
We're killing
ever.
That. And that's where the innovation comes from. I mean, Elon Musk did not start at Tesla. I mean, Thomas Edison did not start with GE. I mean, these guys started in the – Hewlett Packard started in a garage. Facebook started in a dorm room. All of these companies started small, and that's where the innovation comes from. That's where the S-curve comes in investment and returns on investment, is when they reach the pinnacle of their success, and then they're able to hire people, which adds to our economy. But if you kill small business, you kill innovation in America.
Absolutely. Let's move maybe to unemployment insurance, because this is part of that same puzzle.
Right.
It's not independent of that. It is part of it. So we know that during COVID, there was massive unemployment. The UI was paid out to various claimants. Tell us about what unfurled there in that debacle.
Well, and that goes back to, you know, what I said. I don't think the government had the right to shut down these businesses to cause the unemployment in the first place. Now, if the government is going to do that, then they have to make it right. I considered that eminent domain illegal taking of somebody's prosperity, their paycheck. And the government should make that right, and the government didn't. The government dropped the ball. The EDD, Employment Development Department, was not ready for what was coming with the unemployment insurance claims. They went months without being able to answer their phone, without being able to make their website work, without answering their emails. Every California state senator represents about 1 million people. I had to have 2 full-time people in my district office to answer all of the phone calls from my constituents that were not getting through to the unemployment department. And my constituent services folks helped about 4,000 families get the unemployment benefits that they were due and that the state owed them. So I'm glad that my staff was able to do that, but not everybody knows that you can call your state legislator, your assembly member, or your senator and ask for that help. And so we were very proactive in getting out to the chambers of commerce and the associations. Hey, we're here to help. If you know people that are having a hard time, let us know. And so we were able to solve that for 4,000 people. But how many, I don't even know how many people maybe didn't get that solved because they didn't know to call me or call my office. And then in addition to that, you know, we learned that there was $20 to $30 billion of fraud, waste, and or abuse of that system. And now the state owes the federal government $20 billion in back unemployment benefits that the state has to pay back to the federal government that Governor Newsom could have paid last year out of the surplus, but made a conscious, active, purposeful choice to not do that and burden small businesses with that debt for the next 4 to 7 years until we can pay it back.
Yeah, and that is a staggering amount of fraud.
Right.
I mean, these are the same people that want to run our healthcare system completely in California.
Exactly. And oil refineries now.
Right.
Yeah. And fast food restaurants, by the way. So it goes back to, you know, my colleagues not having this business person and their whole life and their whole career, government has solved their problems, you know, one way or another. They've always had a government paycheck. So they just think that money grows in the government. Right. And so having to solve these problems is they don't understand. Let me go back to, you know, one of the things you said earlier about this new class of legislators coming in, the biggest new class, I think, since 2012 or something like that. And next year will be a big class, too. It's up to the legislators that have been here for a little bit of period of time to put the brakes on this stuff. And I'll just give you an example. SB4, the plastics bill that Senator Allen passed last year, and I support it. I was the only Republican in the Senate to support it. It's a big, audacious goal for the state of California to actually have a positive impact on plastic pollutions, not just in California, but in the oceans and, you know, states and countries next to us. That's huge. I mean, and it's going to take a lot of working it out and getting the proper bureaucracies in place to manage it and do it. And I supported the bill, so I think we can get there. But already this year, freshman legislators are introducing bills to change it or add to it or make it more impactful. Well, we haven't even – so it's up to him and me and other legislators. I mean, hey, whoa, 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 slow down. Let's let these other things work their way out and see what happens. I'm hoping we can do that. We've had – the legislature has a mixed record on that.
So, yeah, no, on the UI stuff, again, you know, the problem with that is, of course, the fraud and all of that. But now it's being born again on the backs of small businesses.
Right.
The proposal
that didn't cause this problem in the
first
place.
Didn't want to have this problem at all. In fact, I find this ironic that they were deemed to be non-essential during the pandemic, but now they're essential enough to foot the bill to recover the EDD.
I hadn't thought about that. That's a really good – you need to write an op-ed on that or an article or something.
Yeah.
No, that you just hit the nail on the head on that. That's really good.
Yeah. $434 per employee on top of everything else.
Right.
$434, right. It'll be actually, that'll come in 2 years. as long as the UI fund is insolvent. That could be in perpetuity. Right. And do you think in this environment that $434 will stay the same? I don't believe
that it will. No, there's no way. And look, my Democratic colleagues, you know, some of them are on our side on this. I do want to be clear about that. But the ones that, again, don't care about that or don't understand that, well, it's just $434. Okay, you give $434. You work for the government. You have the government take $434 out of your paycheck and you pay it. They won't do that. And that's just one thing. The other thing is that's $434 on top of everything else that we've already talked about that's impacting their business in a negative way. Electrical rates and natural gas rates in January that probably put some businesses out of business that were hanging on by a thread in December and were just hoping for a good January, didn't get a good January. And in addition to that, their natural gas bill was three times the normal and their electric bill went up too. You know, I'm sure that wiped some small businesses out that we haven't even heard about yet. And so you add $434 per employee on top of that, that's real money.
Yeah. Well, because they're not used to government money.
Right.
That appears.
Right.
You know, it comes in and it goes out. You know, and the minimum wage is impactful too. It really is. And increasing the minimum wage to $15.50 an hour is hurting businesses as well.
Right.
Dramatically so. And it's a situation in which the businesses just have to make choices, right? They have to let somebody go. They have to reduce hours. There's things that they can do, but it's all very, very challenging for them. And at the end of the day, they become less profitable. Maybe they end up going out of business. But I think one of the real onerous things about minimum wage increases over time is it really prevents our youth from gaining those entry-level jobs.
Right.
I mean, those are the jobs that I think everybody probably in this room has had at some point in time when we were younger. I know you worked 9,000 jobs in your life. But you want people to be on that rung of the economic ladder so that they get in, they're unskilled. Fine, everybody's unskilled when they're 17 years old, 18 years old. And then you learn on the job. And that's part of it too. You learn those valuable work skills on the job so that you can go to the next level. Mm-hmm. Maybe you go to school and then you continue your education and get other jobs. But by raising the minimum wage to excessive levels, those people get left out of the equation. It's never meant to have been a living wage.
Right.
It's an entry-level wage.
Right. What's amazing to me about the debate on the minimum wage, I was in the assembly when we were discussing this. And, you know, remember back in 2012 or 14, whenever it was, I mean, we were moving to $15 an hour and the rest of the country was at $7-something.
$7.25 still right now.
And I get California's expensive. But let's talk about the minimum wage jobs. And I have to always remember the debate we had on the assembly floor as I was outlining basic economics for my colleagues on the assembly floor that for some reason either skipped that class when they were at Berkeley or Davis didn't offer it or, you know, whatever high-end liberal arts school they went to get their theories straight in their head. They didn't learn basic economics that when you're running a business or a government for that matter, and you have a balance sheet that you need to maintain. You got capital and you have labor. The more expensive one becomes, you have to make the other work better. And so I laid this out on the assembly floor. The more we make labor expensive, the more businesses are going to spend capital, basically automation,
yes,
to get these jobs done. And look, a lot of these jobs can be automated. And who does that leave out? That leaves out the beginner. That leaves out the person, just the 16-year-old, 17-year-old, 18-year-old that's trying to, you know, find their way in our economy and what are they going to do for a living. And if you eliminate that job and replace it with a machine, and all we have to do is look at McDonald's right now and what they've done. And they've spent a lot of money on capital. You go into a McDonald's now or even the drive-thru, it's very difficult to order from a person. Everything is automated on a screen, and those aren't cheap screens, by the way. And now they're trying to even automate how to make the hamburger in the back.
There are burger flippers that are automated.
Right. And so who are we hurting? We're hurting the very people that these legislators are trying to say that they're trying to help. Okay, now let's look at the result of minimum wage jobs. Let's look at businesses like In-N-Out Burger, McDonald's, Walmart, Costco for that matter. People that started there in high school or college, minimum wage, Domino's Pizza, where I was. You start, you work there for minimum wage. You work a year, maybe, at minimum wage. And then there's another opportunity that opens up and that pays 10 cents, back in my day, 10 cents more an hour. And you jumped on that opportunity. You took that. It didn't matter what it was, because you knew it was a stepping stone to the next 20-cent an hour raise and then the next 50-cent hour raise. And at all of those businesses I just mentioned, you can climb the ladder through their entire system. They all have training systems, become a general manager, or in the case of McDonald's and Domino's, become a franchisee within 10 years at In-N-Out, you become a general manager, and they're making over $100,000 a year. And all Costco, Walmart, a Walmart general manager makes really good money. They all started as a minimum wage employee on the docks, mopping the floors, working in the food service, whatever. All of those businesses that the people that are running them now started at a minimum wage job. They're not college educated. You don't have to have a college education to run a McDonald's or a In-N-Out or be an assistant general manager at Costco.
And that's always been the beauty of the United States, right? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Right.
And but those are a case in point.
Now what we've done in California is in that McDonald's now, 5 to 10 of those entry-level jobs have been replaced with a $50,000 computer monitor that's taking your order and still doesn't get it right any better than the kid did given, you know, taking your order in the first place.
And the numbers that I've seen indicate that automation costs about $1 an hour to run.
Right.
So you're priced out of the market. Plus, they don't need health care.
Right.
Plus, they don't get paid time leave off. They don't call in sick.
Right.
And that has been driven by driving up the cost, driving up minimum wage.
So I gave that beautiful speech, more condensed than what I just did here, on the assembly floor. And Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, who serves with me in San Diego County, now the Secretary of State, stands up and starts talking about buggy whips and horse-drawn carriages, and that things move on, and we don't have buggy whip makers anymore. And I'm like, that's a totally different, that's the market moving away from horse-drawn carriages and buggy whips. This is the government shutting down jobs that are legitimate and are needed in our economy. And she's a college professor, is equating the market replacing things with government intrusion replacing things.
In the business world, that's called technological obsolescence. Right?
Right.
You have a rotary phone. It works for a while. Now you have cell phones. Nobody's using rotary phones anymore.
Right.
It goes away.
Right.
But that's market driven.
Yes, correct.
That's
when the market drives it, it's always more efficient. It always leads to better products, less expensive, more supply. When the government does it, it always leads to a contraction in the economy, leads to shortages and scarcity.
Well, and at a real fundamental level, I think you're getting to the real nub of the issue. Like, I like your tie you're wearing right now. If I wanted to buy that tie from you, you might say, yeah, you can have it for $10, you can't have it, or you could have it for $40 or whatever, right?
Right.
What does the government have to do with you and I deciding a price that I'm willing to pay for that tie? They don't need to be in the middle of that equation.
Well, and that goes back to, you know, understanding of our economy and the basic founding principles of our country, which I guess aren't taught in higher education in California anymore. Otherwise, more people would understand that. And my colleague Shirley Weber would have understood that and knowing that there's economic consequences when the government gets involved.
And they're usually bad.
And they're almost always bad.
Right.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm James Beckwith, President and CEO of Five Star Bank. We are excited to help bring you this series of podcasts focused on small business concerns in conjunction with the NFIB. When Five Star Bank was founded in 1999, it was business and community leaders, local entrepreneurs, who wanted to create the sort of personalized banking services they desired themselves. Services inspired by partnership and defined by shared vision and goals. A true understanding of the needs of small business owners. I know a meaningful relationship with a banker can be hard to find. At Five Star Bank, we are responsive, understand your business, and are committed to your success. We want to be a part of your growth and a valued partner supporting your vision and your dreams. You'll find direct access to a banker, complete online and mobile business banking you need to succeed. As an SBA preferred lender, let us help you with your startup business or existing business. If you're looking to make a change, please give us the opportunity to demonstrate what our personalized banking services could mean for you. I promise you individual attention from our colleagues who understand your business and are as committed to your success as you are. You can find us online at fivestarbank.com.
Senator, talk to us a little bit about the gas tax. I know you've been very active on the gas tax. I'd like to hear what your current thoughts are, where that might be moving in the future.
I would like to just contemplate for a minute the California government and every three-letter agency that's, you know, DRE, Department of Real Estate, BOE, Board of Equalization, FTB, Franchise Tax Board, DMV, Department of Motor Vehicles, EDD, we already talked about, Employment Development Department. And which one of those departments are you like really impressed with? I mean, they're doing such a great job. The CalGEM is the department that oversees all of the mineral wealth in California as far as mining, oil extraction.
Lithium extraction,
that kind of stuff. I mean, are you just like really excited about is doing, besides public safety? Because I will tell you, Cal Fire, CHP, Cal OES, they're doing a great job. The electrical ISO, the independent system operator for the electrical grid, who's doing a great job that says to you, you know what, let's give the state of California more control over our economy and our businesses. And that's exactly where the governor is going with this gas proposal to lower the price of gasoline in California by adding a tax, Gavin's tax, to the oil companies for making too much money. And that the gasoline is too expensive in California. Gasoline is too expensive in California because we're not extracting it here, we're not refining it here, and we're not shipping it throughout our own state. We're bringing gasoline and oil in from other countries, made in other countries, on tanker ships that burn diesel fuel to get it here from countries that don't have the environmental policies or the labor policies that we have here in California. California is the safest, most reliable, and I say safest both for the economy and for the workers, than any place else in the world. We should be getting more oil from California, not less. And this proposal opens a whole new bureaucracy he wants to put inside the California Energy Commission of unelected bureaucrats to tell every level of where we get gasoline from the ground to our car on how to do their business. And they did this last year with the fast food industry. This governor thinks that he can control everything from Sacramento and run it better than the private companies that are already doing it. And we just know it's going to be a fiasco. We know prices are going to go up. Again, back to when government takes over and takes control, there's scarcity and a drop in supply, and prices go up. So if we want to lower price of gas in California, the easiest way to do it is support my bill, SB 32, that suspends the gas tax for up to a year. That immediately drops the price of gasoline $1 per gallon. Every gallon of gasoline that you buy, the first dollar of every gallon, doesn't matter if it's $3 a gallon or $8 a gallon, the first dollar goes to the state. And so who's making the absurd profits off of gasoline? The state is. These companies aren't making $1 a gallon off this fuel.
And I notice our roads aren't that great. I know we have the highest gas tax in the country. And I saw some survey where we're 49th worst in terms of our roads. So we're almost 100% the highest in gas taxes, which are supposed to go to repair the roads. And our roads are virtually the worst in the country.
You know, it's amazing. My parents moved to California in 1978. I was 10 years old from Colorado. My dad was a home builder in Colorado. Had his own business, worked for himself, had worked really hard to build up to that, to where he could do that. We came out to San Diego on vacation to visit an aunt and uncle. He put in 8 job applications just on a whim, got 10 job offers. He got more offers than applications he put in or resumes that he submitted. We went home, we packed up the U-Haul, and we moved to California. It was the best in education. It was the best in the roads. It was the best in water infrastructure. It was the best in highways. It was the best in higher education. It was the best. Everything was the best in 1978. California was the golden state, the land of opportunity. And the government since then has gone backwards on that and moved us to the worst of the worst in every category just about.
Yeah. You know, it's a beautiful state.
Right.
But it's a gorgeous state.
This state is unbelievably beautiful. I have a venture motorcycle. I have a Jeep. I mountain bike. I'm all over the state enjoying the outdoors. And, you know, from riding my motorcycle up Highway 49 through the foothills and then over to the coast and down Highway 1, you know, back to San Diego, mountain biking in Big Bear or North Star or Mammoth, jeeping all over the Anzabrego Desert. This state is unbelievable.
Yeah, I'll be right over, by the way.
Yeah. the only thing that's messing it up right now is our government.
Right.
Everything that was here in 1978 is still here. All the natural resources are here. All the smart, well, most of the smart people, some of them have moved away. You know, all of the good things that were here in 19 are still here. It's just the policies and procedures and taxes that are killing the state right now.
So most things are cyclical. Do you think we will ever be in a place again where we can remedy these? I mean, it's very hard to remedy this when you have a supermajority in both houses. It's very challenging. We can talk about it, but it's hard to affect any real change. What is the future
look
like? Yeah,
I think
like?
It is cyclical. One of the radio hosts down in San Diego did a special a couple weeks ago, and he's talking about a 30-year cycle. And he was talking specifically about the public's attitude towards policing. You look at 1968, we had the Watts riots. 1998, 1990s, we had the L.A. riots. Now we have, you know, we had the riots a couple years ago. But also the homeless issue is, you know, runs on a cycle, it seems like. You know, I remember in 1980, you would never go downtown San Diego because it was just a mess. And then Pete Wilson became mayor, started cleaning it up, and we got San Diego to be America's finest city. You look at governments and you look at, well, even here in California, in 1935, Republicans were the majority, supermajority. From 1900 to 1935, Republicans were the supermajority in both houses. So it is cyclical. Voters have to get to the point where they're fed up. And really for your listeners, the business owners who are already fed up, they've got to find a way to communicate with their team members. I think business owners have a kind of like this attitude they have to protect their employees from, you know, the impacts of all this. I'm telling business owners, no, share with your employees what is going on and how when a local city doesn't enforce homeless encampments and they're camped on your front porch and people don't come to your business anymore because they can't get into it or they're nervous, that's a local control issue that everybody needs to be putting pressure on those elected officials, city council members, mayors, same at the state level. Business owners, you're at the point where, like, the gloves are off at this point in time. You're fighting for your survival.
Right. It's just such an uphill battle, given the two-thirds.
It is an uphill battle. Your members and your listeners, just, you know, this is the time to double down. If we're going to save the state, it's going to be in the next 4 years. And, you know, and I really think in 2024, it's very important who we elect into the state legislature and at the local level. And look, there's Democrats that are worth voting for that understand this stuff. But for the most part, you got to be very careful on who you're voting for. And look, not every Republican is perfect. I'm not proposing that either. But who's got the economic background to understand what's really happening in our state right now? And then start helping them get elected. And you guys do such a great job in Sacramento. I think one of the things I appreciate about NFIB, you know, obviously my wife and I are members, and you do a good job and all that. But even though you guys are telling a story, as I've said before, that many of my colleagues don't understand, you're doing it in a way that you don't put people off. You don't offend people. You don't irritate people. You're standing your ground. You're telling the truth, but you guys do it in such a manner that, like, people like you. And so that gives you the ability to have conversations that, you know, maybe if somebody went up there with fire and brimstone, they wouldn't be able to have that audience with the legislature, but you guys are able to do that.
No, I understand what you're saying. I think that is part of the core people that we have involved. I mean, we've all been in committees and where there's always one guy who gets up and he opposes everything every single time, every single bill. And I think if you do too much of that, you kind of lose your street cred
right. A
little bit. So I think we're very thoughtful, but when we go to the mattresses, we do go to the mattresses. And we do stand our ground.
Right.
And it's important for the viability and the economic stability of the state.
That's why I'm a member.
Thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it. It's been very enlightening, and thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Tim. It's been great being here, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Tim. And thank you, Senator Jones, for your insights on this podcast. Again, we'd like to thank Five Star Bank for its generous support of this and future podcasts. You can learn more about Five Star Bank at fivestarbank.com. You can find all NFIB California podcasts at nfib.com/ca/podcasts. That's nfib.com/ca/podcasts. You can also find our podcast on your favorite podcast app by searching NFIB California. I would also like to thank MultiPoint Content Strategies for its production of this podcast. You can learn more about them at multipointstrategies.com. Why podcast for small business? It's been NFIB's educational mission for 80 years to remind policymakers that small businesses are not smaller versions of big businesses, and that a one-size-fits-all rule, regulation, or tax can do Main Street enterprises more harm than good. We hope these podcasts aid in better understanding. Finally, thank you to our listeners. If you like what you heard, please share this episode, subscribe, and give us a positive rating. We would appreciate it.